Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluik, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show,
I'm hopeful that it will definitely set a precedent. All Australia's states and territories had laws against homosexuality at some stage.
Tasmania could become a trailblazer on compensating LGBTIQ plus Tasmanians over previous convictions of just being gay. We have all the details. Also, we found out what exactly is an electorate and if Australia could be one of them. And later today,
one of the things that's really amazing here at Culture Mix is that when you walk around, you can see the expressions of people from all over the world in what they're wearing and the foods they're eating.
Illawarra celebrated its multicultural community with a festival showcasing how culture is shaping Australia. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, a new petition is asking the Melbourne City Council to remove security guards who are targeting homeless people in the CBD area. The Homeless Persons Union of Victoria claims this is a violation of human rights and labels homeless people as criminals. The City Council says it's part of a four-year plan of making Melbourne the best and fairest city, with $2 million dedicated to employ security guards. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked founding member of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, Patrick Schiappoloni, to give an idea of what's happening in Melbourne CBD.
So earlier this year, the Future Melbourne Committee, which is a committee developed by the City of Melbourne, they wanted to improve the safety and security of their workers and the public. They claim that there are declining perceptions of safety, particularly at night, and this is really important, on public transport and by women and young people. So this is around safe on public transport, and this is particularly by women and young people. And so they engage the services of this Crownland Security to improve the safety of their workers. They've employed security guards to protect what they say their local law officers while they're doing their job when it comes to begging, antisocial behaviour, drinking in public and begging. The concerns around safety at night and on public transport, the security guards won't be working on at night and they're not working on public transport. So specifically what they've identified 37 acts of violence, undefined acts of violence over 2 years to justify the $2 million they're spending on security guards to basically intimidate people with truncheons, handcuffs, and they'll be able to make citizens' arrests targeting the homeless community.
What has the reaction been from homeless Australians or members of the union about this particular issue of using community guards and targeting them?
Okay, they're demoralised. They feel intimidated. I interviewed a number of rough sleepers in the CBD a couple of weeks ago, and they're intimidated. They feel demoralised. They feel like they're not being heard. They feel like they're being targeted. The response has been they're very upset because it's an outrage. They've been set up to be the enemy when they're not. The homeless people who are experiencing homelessness in the CBD are people who have experienced severe trauma that's forced them out of their housing, especially economic inequality, because benefits are so low. Many people have lost their jobs. Many people have had breakdown in relationships that's forced them out of their housing. Many people have experienced family and domestic violence that's forced them out of their accommodation. So the other thing to remember is that all the services that support people who are homeless are located in the CBD. So that's where the laundries are. That's where the kit, access to food is. That's where the free doctors are, like the health services are all located in the CBD. So that's where they need to be if they want to be able to conduct their lives with some dignity.
Pat, could you please tell us a little bit more about the campaign or about the petition on change.org that you have running about this issue?
the Homeless Persons Union has established a petition so that we could collect signatures and also encourage people to make submissions to the City of Melbourne outlining their objections or their opposition to this draconian policy, public policy, or the use of security guards to target the homeless community. So we've encouraged people to sign a petition to put pressure on the City of Melbourne Council to abolish this policy because we think it's a regressive one. We think it's a harmful one on people's lives, especially homeless people's lives. And so we encourage people to sign the petition.
And what would you like to see instead of the guards targeting people across the CBD?
We would like to see enhanced community services, more outreach services, more access to support, like harm reduction programs for people that are using drugs, more public housing for people that are homeless, more access drop-in services, public kitchens, public showers, public laundries where people can go so that they can improve their quality of life. Outreach workers, people who've had a lived experience, develop a relationship with people who are experiencing homelessness in the CBD. Storage. See, this is one of the issues that's creating a lot of conflict, is people are having their belongings taken by local law officers. They're doing their job, but they're taking people's stuff. And so anyone knows that when you lose your belongings, like you lose your wallet, or your bedding, your sleeping bag, photos of your family, it's an upsetting situation. So they're constantly confronted with local law officers taking their belongings on a daily basis and not being able to get them back. So we would like for the City of Melbourne to establish some storage for the homeless community.
That was spokesperson from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, Patrick Schiappoloni, speaking to The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. The Wire contacted Melbourne City Council for comment. Tasmania is taking the lead with historic reform to target LGBTQIA+ convictions by offering compensation to those previously penalised for homosexuality and cross-dressing offences. The two bills have received bipartisan support and are currently being debated in Tasmanian Parliament in an effort to expunge historic offences under former laws. The move aims to improve the state's historically dark relationship with the LGBTQIA+ community after refusing to decriminalise same-sex marriage between men until 1997, making them the last state in Australia to adopt changes. The Wire's Emma Watsky spoke with Equality Tasmania spokesperson Rodney Croom to find out more.
There are two important pieces of legislation before the Tasmanian Parliament now. One is to provide harsher penalties for prejudice and hate-motivated crime. And for the first time, that will include hate crime against LGBTIQA+ people. This legislation is the best in Australia because it includes the widest number of social groups, not just LGBTIQA+ people, but people with disabilities, people of faith, and many others. And it also has the most advanced ways in Australia of trying to determine if crime is motivated by hate and prejudice. The Tasmanian Parliament is currently debating, and I'm hopeful will pass, legislation that will allow the government to provide financial redress, that's financial payments, to people who in the past were victims of the state's former laws against homosexuality and cross-dressing. And Tasmania will be the first place in Australia to allow that kind of redress for people who are victim survivors.
Under the proposed financial redress scheme, what could outcomes look like in a financial sense for those previously charged, convicted or jailed for homosexuality?
A Tasmanian inquiry looked at this. It looked at the compensation that's available overseas in places like Germany and Spain and France and Canada. It came up with three figures, $15,000 for someone who's charged, $45,000 for someone who is charged and convicted, and $75,000 for someone who was given a sentence, like a jail term or fines or sent to a mental asylum. We know that there are some men still alive to whom that happened, or who were given community orders. Although that will not compensate them for all of the trauma and pain they experienced, it will be a way of the Tasmanian government and people saying, we are sorry, this should never have happened.
Tasmania was the last Australian state to decriminalise homosexuality and the only state to criminalise cross-dressing until the year 2000. Now it's set to be the first to offer compensation to these now abolished crimes. What could this political or legislative reform signify at a societal or individual level, do you think?
I think these reforms indicate Tasmania truly has turned a corner, and community attitudes were pretty negative in the 1990s. There were anti-gay rallies in Tasmania to protest against decriminalisation. But since then, Tasmania has changed profoundly.
Do you think that these current bills could potentially set a precedent for the rest of the nation?
I'm hopeful that it will definitely set a precedent. All Australia's states and territories had laws against homosexuality at some stage, even though they were repealed earlier than the laws in Tasmania. For instance, in New South Wales and Victoria, those laws were repealed in the 1980s. In 1989 in WA, in the early 90s in Queensland, in South Australia it was earlier, it was 1975. But in those states where the laws were repealed, at least in the 80s and 90s, there would still be many elderly men around who were victims of those laws and who would benefit immensely from the redress that we're talking about in Tasmania. So I'd strongly urge the other states to seriously consider this and go down the same path. I'd hope that nationally we can have consistent laws which provide some kind of justice for people who experienced that deep injustice. And just to remind your listeners, this was no light thing. The laws against homosexuality were considered very serious at the time. These men were tried in the Supreme Court, so it was covered in the newspapers. At a time when being gay was deeply stigmatised, they would often experience the loss of their jobs, their homes, of their family, their friends, and certainly in Tasmania, many moved interstate, and quite a number took their own lives. The trauma that was inflicted by these old laws is lifelong trauma, and the least we can do, I think, is provide them with some kind of financial recompense when they seek, as is the case in Tasmania, when they seek to have their records expunged, erased, then that payment will be automatic.
And from my understanding, at least 100 men were convicted for, quote, unnatural sexual intercourse and, quote, gross indecency in Tasmania between 1945 and the mid-1980s. Some of those men could possibly be potentially no longer alive. What happens here? Will family receive the compensation, or has that been discussed yet?
You're right that many will have died. Because Tasmania was the last state to decriminalise, there were men arrested and convicted in the 70s and 80s who were still very much with us, and I'm hoping that they will apply for this. I'm personally aware of families that lost loved ones through suicide because they were convicted under these laws. So it is important, I think, that we consider those families. The payment scheme that the Tasmanian government has before Parliament now raises issues in terms of families. Who is the money paid to? If it is paid, what amount it should be? And I'm hopeful that there can be an ongoing discussion about how we help those families through the trauma that they experienced. Still today, the younger members of those families, you know, will have inherited the trauma that their parents or grandparents experienced from having a loved one, a brother or a son or whatever, appear before the Supreme Court and be convicted of being gay.
That was Equality Tasmania spokesperson Rodney Croom speaking with The Wire's Emma Watsky. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankluik in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC, to our listeners in Armidale on Tune FM, and to the other side of the country, to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. As many countries are transitioning away from gas and oil, a new cohort of electrostates are emerging. Underpinned by electrification, electrostates aim to reshape the global energy order, dominated by nations with large fossil fuel reserves, such as the United States, Russia, and the Middle Eastern countries, for a cleaner future. To learn more about electro states and their future, I spoke to Associate Professor Nusha Shafia Badi, Head of Discipline of IT at Australian Catholic University and Adjunct Associate Professor at Charles Darwin University.
An electrostate, because initially in the old days, we had countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia that gained wealth and influence from fossil exports. Now this trend is changing and we are moving towards electrostate. The electrostate are the countries that are rich in clean tech manufacturing and minerals, and they can benefit from these through applying their influence through electricity and clean tech applications. And China is leading in this space.
And speaking of China, could you talk a little bit about how they became the dominant electrostate? Like, what were some of the policies they enacted? What was their journey into getting to where they are now?
Well, one of the things that really was critical was their battery production and semiconductors infrastructure, and also they're very strong in the clean energy tech production like solar, wind and electrical vehicles. For example, they have a process like 60% of global lithium and cobalt. They refine more than 90% of rare earths that are used in electric vehicles, wind turbines and smart grids. They produce 80% of the world's solar panels. So they have dominated the wind turbine supply chain, and that's why they have become a very strong electrostate.
Apart from China, what other countries are considered electrostates? Who's furthest along?
I can say that US and Japan and India are moving towards coming up with strategies to reduce their reliance on these resources on China. So they have had ACT and they have come up with strategies to reduce their reliance on China.
So where's Australia currently at in terms of transitioning? Has it even started? Where's the current position?
Have the capacity to become an electrostate, but we are not there yet. So one of the things that is really strong about Australia is that they already supply more than 50% of global lithium, and that provides us with a strong position. If we go beyond just raw ore exports and we start, you know, investing in domestic refining and battery manufacturing and recycling, so that helps us to capture value through those processes. And from the more broader strategic perspective, if we start forming partnerships across Asia, Europe, Middle East and Africa to start building markets onshore for processing and manufacturing and investing innovation in these green energy storage, you know, or production processes, really it would help us to be in a stronger position to become an electrostate.
I understand you've done work with artificial intelligence, and could that be used to further help Australia in the transition process?
Yes, of course. AI is a very important factor that can help us because we can save a lot of costs in any of these manufacturing processes using AI algorithms and methods. So if we leverage AI, it really helps us get forward and move forward faster.
And Nusha, I've always been curious, you know how the petroleum countries have got that collective group, OPEC? Do you think maybe one day we'll see an equivalent for the electrostates?
It could potentially happen, but because at this stage China is leading this, it really depends on China, because that's a very strong lead on this. Unless the others form an alliance, the other countries that are reducing their reliance on China form an alliance and see what they can do in that regard. But it's likely to happen.
That was Associate Professor Nusha Shafia Badi from the Australian Catholic University. With the Kiama Blues Festival and the Yours and Ours Music Festival, Wollongong and the wider Illawarra region, south of Sydney, already have a reputation for live music. In 2023, the Wollongong Council got 2 years funding for a different kind of event, the Cultural Mix Festival, to celebrate the music, food, and stories of its culturally and linguistically diverse communities. Earlier this year, the Wollongong Council received funding to run the event for a third year, and the Wise contributor from FBI Radio Kwame Schlosser reports.
Last weekend, thousands of people descended on Wollongong for the third iteration of Wollongong's multicultural festival, Culture Mix. On Saturday, the festival was a one-day event, instead of the two-day festival that it has been the past 2 years. And that's because the initial funding from the Multicultural New South Wales had only been for the 2 years. This year's event was funded by a $250,000 grant under the New South Wales Government's Stronger Together Local Council Major Festival Programme. And just like the two previous years, there was music, dance, visual arts, all celebrating Wollongong's diversity. Parts of Crown Street, one of the main arteries of the city, was blocked off for tents displaying food and other goods from around the world. Among them were local organisations that support culturally and linguistically diverse communities.
Hi, my name's Annie Burbrook and I'm from the Illawarra Multicultural Services.
Annie is the Community Hub Support Coordinator at the Illawarra Multicultural Services, or the IMS, and she explains why Culture Mix is so important to Wollongong and the wider Illawarra community.
It's a real celebration of our true multiculturalism and what that really means, which is people coming together, living together, working together, finding out about each other, learning from each other. Yeah, it's a celebration.
This is the third iteration of this celebration festival event. How is it changed, or is it exactly the same? How have you seen it evolve?
It has developed and changed over the last 3 years. It was started because there was a real need for us to have some sort of event in Wollongong to mark our incredible community and to acknowledge that. It's got bigger every year. There are lots and lots of people from cultural backgrounds are serving food or performing, doing amazing things. So it's very much about expanding and learning each year the lessons from the previous year. So, yeah.
I see there's a big map on the ground and people are putting little tags down. What are they doing?
So we're having a fantastic game at our Illawarra Multicultural Services store. We've got two language exercises. So this first one has a huge map of the world, and we've cut out the different languages that are some of the languages that are spoken in Wollongong. There are actually 94 languages spoken in Wollongong, so we haven't got 94 there for people to choose from. But we picked some common ones and some where people are going, I have never even heard of this language. And the idea is for them to sit down with one of our staff and work out where those languages go on the map. And people are asking fabulous questions and learning a lot. And then when we say all of these languages are spoken here, they can actually see where the people have come from. So it's a way of making that a visual thing. And then over here, we can sit down and actually listen to people saying about 20 seconds worth of conversation in language, and they have to guess. We've only got seven languages, but again, people are going, oh, wow, I've never even heard that language. I didn't know that that was spoken here.
And while the IMS focused on celebrating the 94 different languages that make up the Illawarra region, the Multicultural Communities Council of Illawarra CEO Chris Lacey talked about how the MCCI was celebrating the migration journeys of those languages to Wollongong.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really amazing here at Culture Mix is that when you walk around, you can see the expressions of people from all over the world in what they're wearing and the foods they're eating. We've decided to showcase that visually on a really large world map. And we're inviting people who are here at Culture Mix today to come in and put a pin on that map and a string that links back to Wollongong so that we can see the migration journeys of where all of Wollongong's people have come from. And so far today we can see that there's quite a lot of people from Europe and also from the subcontinent and South Asia. We're also seeing some South Americans. There's a number of South American pins on the map at the moment. But by the end of the day, we'll have hundreds of migration journeys expressed on this map, and it'll be a great visual expression of Wollongong's diversity.
The festival goers were also being encouraged to participate in the making of a mural.
I'm Janine. I'm one of the Wollongong Council arts and culture workers, and this is an interactive mural. It was painted, installed this week by local artist Mignon Steele. And the idea is that everyone in the community can come along today and make their mark. And got a whole heap of people here, yeah, joining in of all ages to responding to what Mignon started.
FBI's Kwame Schlosser with the report. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week, same time, on your local station. And if you'd like to listen to any one of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries where this program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. I'm Tony Pankaluik. Thanks so much for your company. And we'll see you next time on The Wire.